Heads up, this episode is about macho culture in kitchens, so there's going to be some cursing. Well, I wonder if most restaurants that I'll eat at are run the way that Gordon Ramsay would run his restaurants, you know? Where he's just screaming.
Come here, you. What are you doing? Just what the fuck are you doing? You're standing there, you're screwing me, and you're
fucking... I spent a couple days working at some of his restaurants in London. They were intense.
Oh, man.
Definitely the most abusive restaurants I've ever seen. There was a lot of yelling and cursing. I mean, the worst thing I saw was one of the chefs throwing a pan that had just had hot sauce in it at a cook, hitting the cook on the chest with a hot pan, like splashing them with hot sauce. I saw a cook, like a chef, plating a scallop that was a little bit overcooked, and he picked it up and threw it at a cook, at the guy who cooked it.
That's so brutal.
Yeah. And on one end, it's like, Jesus, these are just assholes. But
yeah, seriously.
You know, but on the other end, it's like, all right, well, like, it's a business model that's working for them. So, like, what is the incentive for them to stop doing that, you know?
A lot of us have laughed at this kind of thing when hilarious celebrity chefs did it on TV. Abuse in restaurants is so common that it's a reality TV cliche. But there's a slow reckoning underway for many of those chefs. Kenji Lopez Alt doesn't deny he's had his own moments of succumbing to this culture. On some level, I get it. Kitchens are intense places, and their military-like structure can mean harsh and even brutal treatment. But Kenji has his own kitchen now, and his years on the other side of the power divide mean he's going to be doing things a lot differently. I'm Ayman Ismail, and you're listening to Man Up. On this show every week, we tell honest stories about our lives and investigate where we get our ideas about what it means to be a man. Kenji has been cooking in kitchens for decades, and he's also a god to amateur cooks obsessed with the science behind every step of every recipe. Now, for the first time, he's running his own restaurant. He's the kind of guy you might expect to be a yeller behind the scenes, but he's decidedly different than what I expected.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
Kitchens, the way they're traditionally structured and the way that the culture traditionally is, there is a very strict power structure, and it's a very steep pyramid, and the person at the top has a lot of power over everyone else, like literally over, can
right.
tell them what to do and what not to do, when to be there, when not to be there, and people listen. And so when you give people a lot of power over their employees, it doesn't surprise me the amount of abuse that took place, both the sexual and verbal and physical abuse.
Yeah.
So, you know, especially because kitchens do tend to be all male environments, or women who behave in sort of the traditionally, typically male, macho, what would be typically considered macho ways. And so there does become this, like, you know, locker room culture where people just talk about servers and talk about other and talk about, you know, girls, and like that's just what the, you know, it's like a insecure man thing, you know?
Yeah. No, I was just talking to our producer Cameron, who was telling us about how he heard that in restaurants, cooks will show off their oven burns or heat burns,
oh, yeah,
or scars,
sure.
As if like it was like a battle scar, something to show off.
Yeah, people would definitely compare their scars. And there was definitely, you know, competitiveness in terms of like who can cook the fastest, who can do this the fastest. But, you know, my first sort of fancy restaurant job was at Number 9 Park, where the chef is Barbara Lynch. And she, like, very much fits that mold. It's not that you have to be tough. It's that you have to behave the way men behave, which is, you know, and I don't mean this as any discredit to her, like, and what she's built and what she's done. But she does it in a fashion that's very similar to how very, you know, sort of more macho chefs do it in terms of, you know, in terms of the intensity level and the expectations and the amount of... you know, not as bad as I've seen it in other places, but the amount of yelling that goes on in kitchens.
Yeah.
There's definitely yelling and definitely scary, you know, like, I remember my first week there, like, I'd spent about 45 minutes slicing chives because someone had asked me to.
Right.
And so I was standing there slicing chives for the whole line. And then Barbara comes over and she sees the chives on my cutting board and then just dumps them into the trash. And I was just like looking at it like, you know, and it's like you just like feel like you just died inside because like this thing that you've just been working on was just like thrown in the trash. You know, and then she showed me the right way to do it. But in the end, it's like, all right, like if you're working with a really strong sense of urgency and you're under pressure and the restaurant's about to open and like you don't have time to, you know, sometimes it's like you don't have time to explain to them why you're about to throw your chives in the trash. At least that's the rationale.
Yeah.
And so you do it, and then afterwards you explain why, and you try and teach them better. And I think, you know, that's like a horribly inappropriate thing to do when you're working at a magazine and you're at an editorial meeting and someone throws an idea at a brainstorming session. Like, you shouldn't just immediately trash it and explain why their idea was terrible. Like, it's just, you know, it's like, it's bad. It's bad both on a sort of fundamental human to human interaction level. And it's also just bad for the end result, when you're working in that kind of environment. And so, you know, it's like, just like unlearning behaviors that were sort of built into you, that I would say in, contextually in a kitchen are, I wouldn't consider them like sort of abusive, but when you take them out of the context of the kitchen, they definitely can be. And that was just, you know, that was like on the tamer end of how these, I think, high-end restaurants were in the, and in many cases still are. That's how you got things done like that. You were expected to behave that way. And if you didn't, you were sort of seen as weak.
That's really interesting. It almost felt like you had to conform to a certain degree to survive.
You know, for me, a lot of the kitchens I worked in did sort of, you know, remind me of high school. There's the natural power structures that built up. They're like, all right, like these guys are the bullies. Like, all right, he's like one of the cool guys. Like, oh, he's the slacker. You know, they, like if people have their sort of their breakfast club roles in every professional kitchen, and you know, and the breakdown of them obviously changes. And in some places, they're more more sort of helpful people than others. But in the worst of them, almost everybody is just sort of out for themselves, hyper-competitive, kissing up to the chef type who doesn't have time to answer questions, doesn't have time to talk about the food because they need to move on to the next project or whatever.
So I still don't understand exactly why aggression and like this plain ruthlessness is so normal in kitchens. Is it necessary? Like, why are so many chefs so brutal?
You know, the kitchen system in restaurants came from the French military system. So, you know, so kitchens were literally set up to mimic the military in terms of chain of command. And so you end up with the same sort of military hazing structure where, you know, new people are shat on. And then as you move up the ranks, like, all right, well, like they did it to me and it worked on me, so I'm going to keep doing it to the new guys. Like, it's my turn. So even if like you don't, even if you're not a sadist who personally gets pleasure out of like hazing the new guy, it just becomes like a part of the culture that everyone went through it. And so like now everyone participates on the other end of it. And you end up considering it as a sort of this like type of camaraderie. And, you know, in many ways it is a type of camaraderie, but at the same time, it's a very exclusive camaraderie that occurs at the expense of other people. When you're working in a restaurant, like you have very, very tight deadlines. Like you're constantly working urgently. So definitely like a lot of the sort of normal, you know, niceties of everyday interactions and of like an office job or something would necessarily go by the wayside. And I think that is always going to happen. It's just like, you know, there's intense pressure on chefs and in kitchens to get more done with less resources and less people all the time.
So a few years ago, before he died, Anthony Bourdain did an interview with Slate. And I wanted to read a quote for you so that you can respond. He said, "I have done stupid, offensive shit. And because I was a guy
in a guy's world who had celebrated a system, I was very proud of the fact that I had endured that as a middle-class kid, that I found myself in this very old, very frankly, phallocentric, very oppressive system, and I was proud of myself for surviving it, and I celebrated that, and rather, you know, enthusiastically."
Does that resonate with you at all?
Yeah, absolutely. you know, Anthony Bourdain's book, Kitchen Confidential, came out right around the time I was starting to work in professional kitchens and thinking about going into it as a career. And so it definitely like had a major influence on me. And so, yeah, for sure. Like at that time I was like, oh yeah, you know, like kitchens, like cooking and, you know, like rock and roll, let's go. And so I that sort of life, you know, not necessarily the criminal elements of it, but the sort of adrenaline and like the challenge to yourself every day and like the competitiveness of it did really appeal to me at the time. But, you know, definitely, I think just in the same way that Bourdain did, like, I'm glad that I've changed my ideas about that and thought about it a lot more and no longer want to participate. And, you know, in a sense, you know, Anthony, I think Bourdain, like, personally had it bad because, you know, he wrote that book that glorified it. And then years later, he had to sort of live with the fact that this book has left a legacy. I got out of restaurants and went into writing and sort of learned a lot of these lessons before, you know, writing my book or before sort of really finding my voice and starting my current career. But yeah, you know, I was definitely like sort of part of that world when I was a cook.
But you don't run your kitchen that way, right? Like you were describing your kitchen as having a totally different culture, one where if someone were to mess up, you would help them understand it afterwards, maybe after it was closing.
Well, especially if it's sort of like a personnel related thing where it's like, you know, if there are people who are having a problem or if someone is like slacking off or whatever, definitely, yeah, we never like dress down in public, you know, and those things, I think those things are good because I think, you don't want to go into your job and then come home feeling like shit. Like you don't want to get publicly dressed down. You don't want to feel miserable. Like you want to go home feeling like, you know, you did your job and like, you know, maybe there's a couple things you can improve and that, but you're that excited to go in and work on them the next time. And so that is, you know, sort of what we try and do.
At the start of this interview, I was hoping to understand why so many kitchens operate like a boot camp, where everyone is subject to routine abuse. But at this point, I'm more interested in the transition Kenji is describing, how he moved on from that. I have zero doubt he knows when people are screwing up, so what's stopping him from throwing a pan of scallops? So I do want to talk about your restaurant, Worst Hall. Mm-hmm. It opened in California last year. So when you were opening that restaurant, what were some things that you were thinking about when it came to changing the kitchen dynamic from what you were used to, maybe from other kitchen jobs?
Well, a lot of it was coming up with those sort of list of rules, the basic list of rules we have. A lot of it was candidate screening for sort of management level positions. And then also sort of actively finding ways to make it understood that your culture is different, to attract candidates, to attract people to a place where they expect to be treated differently and expect to behave differently. So a lot of it is like thinking about what the frustration points were for me when I was working in restaurants and figuring out ways to address them. And then also a lot of it is sort of figuring out reading a lot of, talking to a lot of women chefs and reading a lot of feminist writing and figuring out good ways to attract and retain like a well-balanced gender representation in your kitchen. Because you know, I really believe that does help with the culture element.
It almost feels like you're taking more of a soft touch versus more of an authoritarian culture. So
And it's not like we're totally soft. It's like, you know, we're still a restaurant. We still have to serve food. It still has to be consistent. We still have a very tight budget. So, you know, people still work hard. But we very consciously avoid the abusive and belittling behavior that other restaurants have. And we take sort of active steps to make sure that people treat each other with respect.
One thing that stood out to me about your answer, though, you were very deliberate in saying, no, it is a soft touch, but people are still working hard. That made me wonder if you do need a certain degree of tough love, maybe not what you see in Gordon Ramsay shows where he's just calling people an idiot sandwich.
Yeah. So it is a fine edge to ride on, you know, like especially in the middle of service when it's hectic and there's orders and people waiting for their food and someone makes a mistake. Like it is definitely a fine line to ride where it's like, all right, like how much do they need to be explained or disciplined right now so that they produce acceptable results for the rest of the night versus how far is too far that they feel like they've you know, that feel humiliated and feel like they're going to be dejected for the rest of the night, or, you know, or in the worst cases, they're going to walk off and leave because you've injured insulted their pride.
Right. So how do you reprimand someone if someone were, for example, to be chopping chives and they were to totally mess it up and this batch was worthless and you had to throw it out? How would you handle that?
So that literally happened today. So I don't even have to give it to you hypothetically. That literally happened today, the chive thing. So I was at the restaurant this morning, and David, one of our line cooks, this was like at 10:30 a.m., so about half an hour before we opened for lunch, and one of our line cooks was chopping chives. And with chives, you can hear it when they're being chopped properly. So like what you're supposed to do is slice them with a sharp knife. Mm-hmm. And when you slice them, they kind of go like shh, shh, like a very quiet sound. And whereas when you chop them, it does this kind of like shh, 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 like this crunchy sound. And what that sound is the sound of like cells being crushed. And so you can hear when someone's chopping chives wrong. And so I heard that. And so I walked over and I looked. And so in this case, like, it was before we opened. And so I just walked behind the line and I said, hey, like, can I just show you something real quick? And then like we checked his knife and saw that it wasn't sharp enough, went and got a sharper knife. And then I showed him like how when you do more horizontal motion with the knife, you get cleaner cuts than if you do more up and down motion for this, you know, for this specific task. And so, and then the chives that he had crushed, we used them in our spetzel batter, where it doesn't matter if they're crushed a little bit. But this is a relatively easy example because it wasn't during service, so I didn't have to make that flash decision of like, all right, like, do I stop him now and like and make this short and like just tell him to change without explanation in front of everyone, or do I wait until after service where I can give him more time? But you know, the long answer is, there are times for sure when whoever is expediting, the chef on duty, has to immediately tell someone, hey, like, stop doing it that way, do it this way, I'll explain later, and expect them to do it, and people will do it. But you know, one of our basic rules is like, if you know, it's always important to explain why. And you know, I think this is important for writing, for running a kitchen, for raising a baby. You know, it's like you always explain why, because you want the person to understand their mistake and understand why you want them to do it a different way. Because if you don't, then like, you know, they're going to fall into the habit again, or they're going to just think you're being bossy for the sake of being bossy. So whether it's at the moment when you have time, like today where I had time before service, or it's after the rush and you're in between services or at the end of the night, you always want to explain why you told someone to do something, so that, you know, they know that you're not just being arbitrary.
So I'm really curious about this transition. I want to know how you decided that you wanted to run your restaurant differently. How did you repel that feeling like you needed to run things the way that they've always been run? How did that happen?
So I'd been out of the industry for about 10 years and worked in other environments. So I guess seeing how other environments operate and how normal human interactions are, like, definitely affected me. Also, I think a lot of self-reflection and realizing, thinking about like what actions I've done that have harmed other people versus helped, and ways I could modify my behavior. You know, and a lot of that, you know, very much driven by conversations I've had with my wife, who's also a very devout feminist.
Yeah. So for me personally, this like wanting to change was always easier said than done. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, it's very easy to first like decide that there's something that you want to change about yourself,
right?
But it requires a certain level of introspection. For you, it feels like you were very comfortable with confronting it head on.
No, I definitely wouldn't say that. It took me years to do, and it was, especially at the beginning, it was very, very difficult. Ask any of my friends what I was like 10 years ago, or my wife what I was like 10 years ago. And it was definitely a long and difficult process, and ongoing. And, you know, I think it's always an ongoing process. You always have to sort of continually sort of self-reflect.
Yeah. Do you mind giving us a little bit more insight into what that process was like?
I would say a lot of it was, you know, it stemmed from confrontation from like friends and family and my wife. You know, like when you're in college, people don't talk about feelings much. And so so you sort of develop behaviors in college, and like it's cool to be an asshole and all these things. And it's like, and nobody ever tells you, you know what? It's not cool to be an asshole. and then, you know, then I went straight from college to working in restaurants where it's cool to be an asshole. And nobody ever told me, you know what? It's not cool to be an asshole. And so it, when I got out, you know, that was like a solid, whatever it was, 10 years of just thinking, being of it being reinforced that it's cool to be an asshole. And it's cool to be competitive and aggressive and all these things. And so I didn't even realize like that I was an asshole. And until, you know, like, you know, one time, like I like belittled my roommate because she made pancakes from a boxed mix instead of making them from like raw ingredients. And then like, you know, a friend was over for breakfast and like afterwards he came to me, he's like, you know, like that was like, you're an asshole. Like you just like, you made her feel really terrible. And they were like, what was the point of that? And so it's like things like that, that really make you think like, what, you know, what other things have I been doing that have been like hurting these people who I care about? And like, and what is like, why is the equation that's currently in my head so fucked up? And like, why do I think it's worth hurting these people just for these dumb things? Like the number of ingredients in your pancake, you know, it's like dumb. Like it's a matter of like your priorities getting thrown off whack and you really having to sit down and think about what is important and what your priorities are and then modifying your behavior based on that.
Yeah, I can imagine what that moment was like for Kenji, recognizing the abuse he dreaded from his earlier restaurant jobs and himself. Macho kitchen culture is foreign to me, but I can think of plenty of moments where I was that guy. And maybe all it takes to start changing is realizing that you've probably been him too. And that's the show. Thanks for listening. Just another reminder here that we do love getting emails and voicemails here at Man Up, and we'd love to hear from you too. So if you have thoughts about this week's episode or maybe some ideas about what to talk about next, leave a message at 805-626-8707. That's 805-MANUP07. Or you can email us at manup@slate.com. So if you like this episode, please consider supporting the kid and leave a review in Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. Not only do we appreciate it, it also helps other people find the show too. Man Up is hosted and written by me, Ayman Ismail. Our producers are Danielle Hewitt and Cameron Drews. Our executive producers are Jeffrey Bloomer and Lowen Liu. Gabriel Roth is the editorial director of Slate Podcasts. And June Thomas is the senior managing producer of Slate Podcasts. Make sure you're subscribed because we'll be back next week with more Man Up. You won't want to miss it.